Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 8th of January. It was 50 years ago on this very day that President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty in this country, and this is part of what he said in his annual message to Congress on the State of the Union.
This administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America. And I urge this Congress and all Americans to join with me in that effort. It will not be a short or easy struggle. No single weapon or strategy will suffice. But we shall not rest until that war is won. The richest nation on earth can afford to win it. We cannot afford to lose it.
It's 50 years later. Have we won? Have we lost? Have we surrendered? One of our guests this hour says the official poverty rate in America is 15%, but a new, more comprehensive Census Bureau definition, which provides a more realistic tab on people's needs and takes into account the effect of government benefits, shows that 16% of Americans are poor, 3 percentage points less than in 1967. It amounts to 50 million people. We'll have two guests with us during the course of this hour. Eduardo Porter is joining us for a big chunk of the hour. He writes about business, economics, and many other matters as a member of the New York Times editorial board. He's worked as a journalist in Mexico City, Tokyo, London, Los Angeles, and other places, was the editor of the Brazilian edition of America Economia, and he covered the Hispanic population of the U.S. for the Wall Street Journal. Later, distinguished professor of public affairs and economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Timothy Smeeting, who is director of the Institute for Research on Poverty. All hour, we welcome your phone calls on this 50th anniversary of the declaration of the war on poverty. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave a message there, we would love to hear from you, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Eduardo Porter, thank you so much for being with us. Good afternoon to you, sir.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. So how effective was the war that we waged on poverty? Did it start out in a significant fashion? Did it lose and then move on? Or did it not start out well? How would you assess it?
I mean, just looking at kind of the evolution of poverty, poverty did drop very sharply in the immediate years after President Johnson made this speech. And then the poverty rate sort of plateaued. And so this could lead some to say that, you know, we lost. In fact, President Reagan famously did say that in the 1980s. He said that we waged the war on poverty and lost. But I think that the real picture is much more complex. It is true that right now the poverty rate is not a lot better than it was in the late 1960s, which is where we have the earliest data using this more complex measure. More comprehensive measure. But the point is that even though the poverty rate has only declined by 3 percentage points from the population, the fighting poverty has become much more difficult. So, in fact, government is doing much more than it did back in the 60s, but the labor market, jobs, are in fact doing less well at allowing working people to have a decent life, right? So more people are falling into poverty before government intervention, and the government is doing actually a better job than it did back then.
Mm-hmm. You talk about, and we sometimes hear this kind of conversation when we talk about poverty, you write that by the standards of the 19th century, practically no American is poor. And if you look at a comparison with a country like Bangladesh, we obviously have many fewer people who are poor. But when you look at us compared to how the poor are doing and how the wealthy are doing in this country, when you look at it by American standards, the picture is not very good.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's lots of ways of measuring poverty. In fact, the United States is perhaps the only rich country that does it in the way that we do. Most other rich countries measure it as how you are faring relative to the middle of the income distribution. You know, in most of Europe and other advanced nations, if you fall below half the middle income, you are considered poor. So it's a kind of a relative measure. Whereas we started measuring this in terms of the price of food back, you know, when President Johnson was making his speech. The poverty line was considered one in when you spent more than a third of your income to buy a standard basket of food, which was considered, you know, the minimum necessary. And that was the official poverty rate. It's still the official poverty rate. However, you know, the census has decided it's not a very good measure because now we spend less of our income on food and more of our income on other things. And hence it has come up with this new measure that looks at, you know, what people really spend today. So today we spend more on housing than in the 60s in relative terms. We spend less on food. We spend much more on medical care. And so this just goes to say that, you know, when you're talking about poverty, you've got to figure out what exact measure you're using. If we were to say, you know, in terms of what people could buy in the 1960s, well, so there's going to be very, very few, well, many fewer Americans in poverty today. But the fact is that, you know, society has moved on, and we now have, like, medical treatments that are considered essential that were not considered essential back then. And hence, the definition of what being poor changes even under this notion of consumption.
Mm-hmm. And then you also look at one of the big changes that has taken place since 50 years ago, and that's how many people in a family are in the workforce. There's an interesting part of your article that says it makes little financial sense for one spouse to get a job if the other spouse has an income of something like $25,000 a year. 50 years ago, there were poor people, two-parent poor people families who were working, but there still were some women who were out of the workforce because that's the way it was, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's right. I mean, our poverty tools, you know, our anti-poverty tools are mainly, I mean, depending on the age that you've got, we've got a few different ones. I mean, for elderly people, Social Security is the main tool against poverty, and it has been very successful in keeping elderly people out of poverty. But for kind of like working age and for children, you have WIC, you have food stamps, you have the child tax credit, and the earned income tax credit. And for adults, well, and for everybody, have food stamps, and you have the earned income tax credit. Problem is with all these different tools is that as you would expect, they phase out as your income increases, right? And so some of them, this can provide a disincentive for people to get a job. So for instance, if you're in a one earner family, and it would be great if the other spouse were to get a job because that would, you know, help lift the family out of poverty. The problem is that it takes you above the threshold where you lose a lot of these benefits. And so you can, you know, actually end up taking home only like 30 cents out of each additional dollar that the family earns. So this is a disincentive to get another job. And so there's some proposals to offer like tax breaks for folks at this point in the population, in the income distribution, so that there won't be this disincentive to get employment.
Mm-hmm. You have mentioned some government programs, the WIC program, food stamp program, Social Security. As you look over 50 years, what government programs would you say have done the most to reduce poverty?
Well, right now, the census does this job, and they look at, you know, what would taking out each program do to the poverty rate? And under this new definition, which is called the supplemental poverty measure, which basically includes all these things that people spend their money on, plus all the government benefits that they get. Social Security is hands down the biggest tool against poverty. If you were to remove Social Security benefits, the poverty rate wouldn't be 16%; it would be like 25%.
Mm.
So it's really huge,
mm-hmm.
and of course, it mostly affects the elderly. If you're talking about working age and Americans and children, it's the earned income tax credit is right by now the biggest thing, and food stamps. We used to have cash welfare, but you know, in the middle of the 1990s, in welfare reform during the Clinton administration, that was essentially it wasn't abolished, but it was reduced by a great deal, and its place was mainly taken by the earned income tax credit. The idea was that providing cash assistance to a family was going to discourage work, and whereas a tax credit that was only given to people who had a job would actually encourage employment. And in fact, that's true. It has encouraged employment. The problem is, and when they're in a moment like the Great Recession that we've experienced recently, and many are still experiencing now, when there are no jobs to be had, this program isn't really quite as effective, because if you don't have a job, you don't get the benefit.
Congress, as you well know, and there is some question as to whether or not they will be able to pass an extension of unemployment benefits. I'm interested in how that debate would have played out 50 years ago today, if it would have been easier, if there had been such a program as it exists today, if it would have been easier to expand unemployment benefits. And what is it about now that's keeping, we're talking about a substantial number of people here who are going to see virtually no income if they're not able to find a job in the next few months, and Congress can't extend these benefits?
Well, I mean, this is kind of a question about the political climate. And, you know, the Johnson administration managed to pass a whole raft of legislation under the umbrella of the war on poverty. So my first answer would be it clearly would have been easier then than in the kind of, like, noxious, polarized, bitter partisan nature of politics today. So right now, any action in Congress seems kind of impossible, right? We're not seeing very much done at all on any front.
Right.
So I do not hold enormous hope for the expansion of unemployment assistance today, although I think it would be very, very helpful, because by some counts, I mean, 5 million people are going to lose unemployment benefits over the course of this year because of the end of the extended benefits. And well, that's a lot of people that are going to be thrown into some really terrible hardship. And if you assume that the labor market, as most economists do, the labor market is not going to suddenly turn around and start booming, that's going to leave a lot of people in a very, very difficult situation. Our unemployment insurance scheme was sort of designed for an economy in which folks pretty quickly get a new job when they're laid off. And that probably held up until, you know, the middle of the 2000s or at least in the late 1990s, that was true. In the era that was once called the Great Moderation, recessions were short and employment was high. And so, you know, and jobs are the best anti-poverty tool. So our unemployment insurance, it was relatively short and relatively stingy, seemed okay.
Mm-hmm.
But if the world is today, when you have very, very extended periods of unemployment, I mean, the main unemployment crisis today is the long-term unemployed, you know, folks that are unemployed way more than 6 months, are way past the standard period of unemployment insurance, then our standard unemployment system isn't really fit for a world like this, right? And we've extended this with these ad hoc measures, but I think it's worth thinking about, well, if the world isn't going to be, you know, one in which one can find a job really quickly after and recessions are shallow and jobs are soon to be found, then we might need to rethink more deeply the kind of assistance programs that we have, and we might need them to be, you know, longer lasting and perhaps more generous.
Eduardo, you mentioned in the article, and I was interested in this comparison when you talk about unemployment insurance, that we are far stingier in this country than people are elsewhere. Can you give us specific examples? Where are people not stingy, and why are they not stingy?
Well, it's the replacement rate. I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but are the replacement rates of unemployment insurance here are, and by this I mean, you know, what chunk of your wage do you get from your unemployment check, right? We get a much smaller percentage of our last wage than workers in pretty much every Western European country.
I see.
In fact, I would say every Western European country.
Hmm.
And we also get them for a much shorter period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So here again, you know, the standard is 26 weeks. In some European countries, you get 2 years worth of unemployment insurance. And so, you know, ours is a more meager program. And again, we thought that it might work if it was true that people, the vast majority of people, get another job before the 26 weeks are elapsed. But, you know, that's clearly not happening now.
We welcome phone calls for Eduardo. Eduardo Porter is our guest this part of our discussion of the war on poverty 50 years ago today. It was announced by President Lyndon Johnson. Eduardo writes about business and economics and lots of matters as a member of the New York Times editorial board. And an article that he wrote about the 50th anniversary caught our attention. So we're talking about poverty then, poverty now, government programs then, government programs now. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Eduardo writes, while politicians' attention has wandered over the past 50 years, poverty remains uncomfortably close to where it was five decades ago, even though President Lyndon Johnson said that this war on poverty can and must be done. And he said it can be done by this summer, and it could be done without any increase in spending, part of his State of the Union address. What do you think? Why is it a controversial area for us, particularly when it comes to expansion of unemployment benefits and the food stamp controversy? What about the visibility of poor in this country now? Do we know who the poor are? Do we see their pictures? Do we hear their stories? What is the role of government in helping people who are poor? 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@WPR.org. The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls for Eduardo, and we start with Brad. Hi, Brad. You're on the air.
Hi there. When Mitt Romney was running for president, he famously said that he's not concerned about the poor because they're all good. They're all taken care of by government programs. And it just showed to me how out of touch he was with the poor. Not surprisingly, he was born into great wealth, like many politicians. The problem with the poor is they don't have any representation in government. Dennis Kucinich was homeless, but of course he's no longer a congressman. And I'd like to ask the guest, why does he think that politicians rarely address the poor, appeal to them, or listen to them?
You know, this would sound horrible, but it's that the poor really do not have a lot of political power. You know, you've got 50 million people, of which, you know, many are kids, and relatively low levels of voting and political participation. And so their political clout is very limited. And you'll see this not only in like statements like that from Mitt Romney, but even, you know, I can recall President Obama's first campaign. I'm not sure. I once wrote a piece about this. I don't think he mentioned poverty once. He talked a lot about the middle class. And, of course, the middle class is a much bigger concept with many more voters in there. But, you know, the poor is kind of like this marginal population that politicians really don't need to cater to, you know, for electoral success. They might, for their own ethics and whatnot, they might care. But it is not a political imperative as the middle class might be and the middle class's needs.
I think he makes an interesting point. It's not just politicians who don't seem to pay much attention. It's really American society. We have a different view of American society, that it's thriving, that it's bustling, that we're all out spending a lot of money. We just don't see many investigative pieces on people who are struggling. And heavens knows, there are a lot of people struggling now. You hear, well, people are working two jobs, but a lot of people are working two jobs and making not very much money. And we hear a lot about an income gap, equality gap that's huge in this country, but we don't see the face of it. Our media doesn't seem to present that to us. And I'm wondering why, Eduardo.
Well, first, I'm not sure that I would agree. The Times just had this very long and compelling and quite exhaustive series of articles focused on a poor girl named Dasani in Brooklyn. I don't know if you read them, but they were quite prominent. And I would say that, you know, the media, maybe it's hard for me to measure. Have we not paid attention to the poor? I would argue that that's probably wrong. Might we pay more attention to the poor and in our coverage? Perhaps that is correct. But I also wanted to say something else. It seems, I mean, these things are not constant. I mean, you can see in the political campaign for the mayor of New York and the victory of Bill de Blasio, you might see that things are changing in this regard. I mean, his campaign was very much focused on income inequality and the idea that there are two New Yorks, one for the very rich, and that we forget there is another one of the very poor.
Yes.
That have not been, you know, that have been kind of like ignored over the past decade or so. And so maybe there is a change going on in the country that has to do with a more discomfort with income inequality, which is kind of like also associated with more awareness of the plight of the poor.
Let's go. Thanks, Brad, for your call. Let's go to Bill in Onalaska. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill. Thanks. What does a person do when they become unemployed? I mean, they become unemployed, they no longer have income, they no longer, you know, really have money to eat and rent and so forth. I mean, there are all these people. Where are they getting the money to eat and to pay their rent? I'm very suspicious, very suspicious, that there is a lot of employment going on that is under the radar. And my second question, my second question was, we always compare with Western Europe, and there's a lot of world out there, you know, besides Western Europe, and they all have different attitudes. Western Europe, you know, has a kind of a, well, one attitude. How do they treat unemployed people in China and in India and in Brazil and in some other very important parts of our world?
Eduardo.
On the first question, I'm sure there must be, you know, employment in the gray economy off the books. I couldn't tell you how big it is. There are some sources for income for the poor. I mean, there are, you know, community kitchens run by municipalities. I mean, you know, the federal government has the food stamps program, and which, you know, amounts to a few hundred dollars a month, on average, to buy food. There is still a little bit of cash welfare, which is called temporary assistance for needy families, but it's very small. But there are some municipal programs, again, and you know, there are in New York, there are shelters for the homeless. There are community kitchens that feed folks. But, yes, there's very little money out there available after you exhaust your unemployment insurance, and that is certainly true. As you're right, I mean, you know, Western Europe is probably the most is a part of the world with the most kind of social spending, and other countries spend much, much less. And the three countries of which you gave an example, Brazil and China and most importantly India, have social assistance programs that are, you know, much smaller than the one of the United States. I would point out that these three countries are considered you know, much less developed than the United States is. Brazil is a middle-income country. China is poorer than Brazil. India is still considered a very, very poor country in terms of, like, income per person. I don't know, probably 1/30th or 1/40th of the income per person in the United States, or maybe even less than that. I mean, these are very poor countries, and so there's less money available. One standard understanding of how nations develop is that they become richer, voters demand more from their governments in terms of, you know, benefits like, you know, healthcare, pensions, these sorts of income security programs. This has been true not only in Europe, but in other rich countries like Canada, Australia, Japan. The U.S. would be a pretty, is an outlier. We are a country in which, you know, our, you know, very fast rate of economic growth has not been accompanied at all by an expansion of government. Our government has remained small compared to those of these other countries. But yes, it's much bigger than in Brazil or in China.
The caller was asking what people do. A lot of people have been counting on food stamps in this country, too. And you start your recent article with this understanding that we have cut food stamps by an average of, I think you say, 7%, which affects 48 million Americans. That's $9 a month in their food stamp allotment. And to people who don't have very much money, I'm sorry, that is a lot of money. It's a major cut in their program. People aren't living high off the hog on food stamps.
No, that's right. I mean, people are just scraping by. And food stamps might be in for further cuts, you know, because food stamps are part of the Farm Bill. And there are, which is up for renewal. In fact, it was up for renewal years ago, and there hasn't been an agreement in Congress for a new food farm bill. But this is going to be back on the table now. And both the House Republicans and the Senate Democrats have different proposals for a new farm bill, and both of these proposals reduce food stamps further. The Democratic bill reduces them by a little bit, the Republican bill by more. But in any case, both of them. So whichever version of the bill or comes out, and if there's a negotiated version that kind of like goes halfway, food stamps are likely to be trimmed some more.
Let's go to Lynn next in Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen and Eduardo. I was calling to comment on a previous caller that a lot of the invisible poor make do because they've got parents like my husband and I who considered ourselves middle class and were supplementing mortgage payments, food and clothing for the children, necessities. And I think what is not anticipated, but I do, is a whole next generation of elderly whose savings have been eaten into because they felt they had to take care of their children and grandchildren. Because there's nothing out there for my kids.
They're having a hard time finding work, Lynn, or what's the story?
My daughter's doing a post-bac because there wasn't anything in her field.
Mm-hmm.
No, the wages, they're stagnant. I have a son who's a policeman in Racine. They have one child. She's a teacher. He's a policeman because wages are stagnant. And I have a disabled son who lives here, and there's nothing for that child. He's 32. There's nothing for him. I've looked and looked and looked. So my husband and I, just because we have to, are supplementing incomes because I'm not going to see my grandbabies fall into a desperate state of poverty.
Eduardo.
Yes, no, this is very interesting. And I think that the point of stagnant wages is not made often enough as one of the causes of what's going on. And it is totally true, and part of it has to do with the erosion of the minimum wage. Back in the late 1960s, one earner family on the minimum wage could keep a family of four right at the poverty line. You know, so one earner making the minimum wage. By now, one earner making on the minimum wage, that same family would be like 40% below the poverty line. So, you know, wages at the bottom have really fallen enormously, and they are no longer provide a sufficient standard of living for workers. And there is an enormous minimum wage economy, you know, in fast food and retail. We're not talking about few people. We're not talking about, like, teenagers waiting for their first job. Minimum wage workers are now older than they used to be, and they are more educated than they used to be. You're talking about adults trying to sustain a family. But also further up on the wage distribution, further up into middle class jobs, we also see wages stagnating and in many instances actually declining over the last 10 and 20 years. And so this has contributed a great deal to not only the increase in poverty, but the stagnation of the middle class. And it shows up in the poverty stats. If you take away the effect of government programs, you know, food stamps, the earned income tax credit, you know, all of that, the poverty rate today would be more than 30%. And that's up from, like, you know, 25%.
Really?
In the late 1960s.
30%?
The thing is, 30%. Mm. So, you know, 3 out of 10, a little bit more than 3 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put the government programs in place, and that reduces it to 16%, which is the statistic that we were talking about earlier.
Right.
So right now, the government really kind of like takes 14% of Americans out of poverty. Back in the late 1960s, it took about 5% or 6% of Americans out of poverty. So it does, you know, so these programs are being asked to do much more than they were asked to do back then, mm-hmm. because the jobs and because wages are really not doing the job.
Mm. Thank you, Lynn. Let's take one more call for you. Same subject. We're just changing guests in a few moments. Tim in Waukesha. Hi.
Yes, hi there. I mean, I don't think anybody could argue that these programs aren't useful, but I think part of the issue is that we hear these stories of abuse where they're taken advantage of, and so they lose some credibility. And, you know, where that previous caller, obviously there's a real solid need for them, but how do you separate those that want to just take advantage of the system from those that truly need it? And that's, I think, where a big struggle is.
Who are those people, Tim? What are you talking about?
Well, I hate to use the term lazy, but the people that just want to live off the government because it's easier that way. You know, you don't have to go to work because the government will take care of you, as opposed to the people that really do need it and have a valid need.
Is it easy to live off the government, Eduardo?
Well, no. I mean, this is really your pretty meager existence, you know. Before let me step a little bit back. I mean, the biggest government assistance right now actually requires you to have a job. That's sort of like the biggest anti-poverty tool, which is the earned income tax credit. It needs you to be employed. You can't be unemployed and get it. But again, this isn't like a lot of money. Per capita spending on—I'm looking at a stat here. Per capita spending on food stamps, which is the biggest, you know, non-employment-related benefit, is like $225 per capita per person. So it's hardly a lavish lifestyle. So I would say, I mean, sort of like theoretically, I think that the caller is right. I mean, you will have, if you provide some cash or other benefits to folks who are not employed, they'll be just a little less likely to seek employment, a little less desperate for a job. But at the levels of benefits that we have, this effect is probably very small. I know the research along these lines about the minimum wage, because the same argument is made about the minimum wage. If you increase the minimum wage, employers will be less likely to hire workers, and you will get less jobs. But it turns out that when you actually measure this out there, the effect is true, but it is very, very small. And so even though, yes, it makes sense to say that this could happen, we really have to measure exactly to what extent it's happening. And the evidence suggests that these effects aren't large at all.
Eduardo, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Eduardo Porter, our guest the first part of the hour, he is on the editorial board of the New York Times, has worked as a journalist in Mexico City, Tokyo, London, Los Angeles, and he writes about business economics. He wrote a recent piece about the war on poverty and poverty in 2014 compared with 50 years ago today that caught our attention. The whole issue has caught our attention partially because we're hearing a little bit more about it and because of today's anniversary date. It was on this day in a speech to the joint session of Congress, State of the Union speech, that President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty. He not only declared a war on poverty, he said that we could really make significant progress in the war. This was January 8th. He gave this speech, and it could be done by the summer, and it could be done without any increase in spending. So 50 years later, are there more poor people? Are there more government programs that have been effective? Are there programs, is there anything out there that lifts people from poverty, and what could lift people from poverty? We continue our conversation. Timothy Smeeting will be joining us next, distinguished professor of public affairs and economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, director of the Institute for Research on Poverty. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Timothy Smeeting is with us now to continue our conversation. Professor Smeeting, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Nice to have you here. I want to ask you, too, because I keep wondering why this is the case. I was reading LBJ's speech yesterday and was really struck by the urgency with which he wanted to start this war on poverty and had these grand plans that this must be done, it can be done, and it will be done in a few short months. Why is it that he took on this issue 50 years ago, and I'm at a loss to find too many people on the political stage nationally today who are making this a priority? What's different?
Oh, thank you, Kathleen. What's different is that the middle class is suffering, too, and only the very top of the distribution is doing well. So the middle class, I heard a couple of the callers in to Eduardo about, you know, the interfamily transfers that need to be made in order to keep your kids or your grandkids from being poor and so forth. And so what we've seen in electoral politics in particular and policymakers is to play to the middle class. And that is probably what I would do if I wanted to get elected too. But you have to remember the poor are there. They're with us. The problem has changed greatly in nature since Johnson, and the solution is something that's really hard to provide, which is jobs that pay enough to keep a family out of poverty. Mm-hmm. That's the real answer. The answer is not an income support program.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I was going to say another thing about Wisconsin in particular is that we've done a pretty good job supplementing what meager earnings people had with that earned income tax credit and with the SNAP or food share program. So we've done a good job in the past 4 or 5 years since the Great Recession in fighting poverty in Wisconsin. But now we're beginning to withdraw support for those programs at a time when we still don't have enough jobs or jobs that pay enough to support families. So the problem's liable to get worse and not better in the near future unless we find a way to create more jobs.
So how do we do that?
Oh, good question. If I knew the answer to that, I'd be in Washington now. But
you must know the answer, though, right?
Oh, sure. Well, part of it is the fact that, you know, we need to, the long-run solution is to increase training for poor people and increase, you know, their employability. That's various sorts of programs, particularly that help youth who aren't going to college. It means improving the quality of our community colleges and so forth, which is something that we've really cut back on in Wisconsin over the past 5 years, to be quite honest with you, compared, let's say, to Minnesota or a number of other states which have expanded help. Then we have to find a way to get businesses involved in creating jobs so that we know what businesses need. And businesses have to get off the sidelines. They have to say, okay, I need a welder. And therefore, if you go to Madison Community College or any other community college and you get trained and certified as a welder, I'll hire you at a specific wage. Mm-hmm. So in other words, what's happened in the past in terms of school-to-work programs for kids who don't go to college are part of the game, getting involved in guaranteeing jobs, or saying giving jobs to young people if they will do the right things to be trained. And part of the issue, of course, is wages, always. Eduardo talked about the minimum wage, and I think we should have a minimum wage that's about somewhere between $9 and $10 myself. I don't think that would hurt the labor market. In fact, I think it would benefit it. And it would give people more money, low-income people who are increasingly minimum wage workers, more money to spend.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you have to increase the demand for jobs. And for those who are less skilled, they need more training to be employable. A big solution out there in the sky, which I'm actually talking with Eduardo about tomorrow.
Oh, you are?
Oh, yeah. He and I have been emailing while you've been talking to him. is sort of jobs last resort. So a number of conservatives, including Paul Ryan and others, say that we should work test food share, particularly if you're a single adult. You know, if you're going to get food share, you have to find a job. And the young men react, well, there aren't any jobs, and you heard some of that today from your other caller.
Yes.
Okay, well, here's a job for you for $10 an hour. We have a job for you. It could be in the public sector. It could be in the private sector. It could be in the nonprofit sector. It might take some sort of a wage credit for a private employer to hire somebody at $10 who, you know, give them $2.50 an hour for 6 months, and then an extra $1,000 if this person is still working for them at the end of the year. Then you could say, okay, if you want to stay in this program, you take a job.
Mm-hmm.
If there were jobs there.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it is creating jobs. Unfortunately, Washington's not doing a lot. It's really hard for a state to create jobs. Wisconsin does a much better job of making sure the people who are eligible get to eat, that's the food share program, and get the earned income tax credit if, you know, they have young kids and they don't make enough to support the kids. We administer, we can help those programs, we can push those programs, we can help people fill out their tax forms, we qualify people for food share. That we can do. But it's really hard to create jobs in the short run, particularly if you're in an economy like Wisconsin's, which was so heavily dependent on manufacturing before the Great Recession.
Yes, it sure has been.
Mm-hmm. Manufacturing output is up. Productivity is up. Output per worker is up. But the number of jobs in manufacturing have been falling nationwide for 30 years. Oh, things have ticked up a little bit since the bottom of the recession in Wisconsin in terms of manufacturing employment, but not nearly enough, and it'll never get back to where it was. So we have to find other things, other solutions. And it's hard for a state to do that, but we could get started by getting employers in the state who are interested in hiring people involved in the hiring process and in the training process.
Yeah. Let's go to phone calls. We have many of them, and the time is getting short. 800-486-8655 is our number. And our guest this part of the show is Professor Timothy Smeeding, Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at UW-Madison, Director of the Institute for Research on Poverty. Loris in Hales Corners. Hi.
Hi. I am hoping that we will start looking a little deeper. We are part of a globalization. I mean, both us buyers and sellers and business, we're all part of the global picture, and we've got to face that. We have a man living in, I think it's Bayview here, he's the president of the Omanhini Cocoa Bean Company. He goes around and gives lectures talking about beyond fair trade. Because his goal is to see that the workers in this West African country, Ghana, have a hand in the manufacture or processing of cocoa beans, because just picking them isn't going to give them very much wealth. We have to make sure that people all over the world have opportunities at making clothes if you live in Bangladesh, staying on your farm, for goodness sake, if you can, we can make that possible instead of big business farming. There's all kinds of things we should be taking a look at.
Professor Smeeding.
Well, that's great. And in fact, Wisconsin is looking at its export market, its foreign export market. That they've been growing, and that's good news. But the jobs that are required to compete, to produce and export, require a little more skill than we've got. Now, there are local solutions. People can do things. Nonprofits can hire people. People have bridges and dams that need fixing and so forth, but somebody has to pay for all of that, and that's the problem. And so private industry needs to get involved. If they need workers, let's give them trained workers. That seems to be the solution. And we're not going to ignore export markets, of course. Even food, it's exported from, Door County and Bay Ridge down to Madison. If you want to talk about trade, that's inside the state, but it's the same idea. And those cherries and some of those fish may be sold internationally, too. So you have to look at wide markets. But you have to produce a better product cheaper and get it out there. That's competition. And so businesses which think they can do that need to be encouraged to hire. And encouraged, we hope, to hire people locally. You can't produce Door County cherries in China. That's for example.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Loris, for the call. Mike in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, Mike.
All right. She kind of took part of my idea, the fact of, all the work being sent overseas, Mexico and so on. I mean, I had family who worked at a manufacturing company that closed down and was sent to Mexico. And, I mean, that doesn't help. And the whole reason they're doing it is just to up profits to look good on Wall Street. And their company profits are insane. I had a company that I worked for put out an email saying, hey, thanks for helping us make $3 billion this past year. And, we'll try to do something for you. Well, they did nothing.
What's the role of corporate greed, Professor Smeeting?
Well, it's strong in many cases. I'm not going to disagree with what this gentleman just mentioned. Corporations are in business to make profit. Corporations will produce products that they can sell at the lowest possible cost. And that cost sometimes means robotization. Sometimes it means destroying plants in one place and putting them up in another place. And it is about profit. And right now, those who are investors who own the corporations or who own the robots, which is one of my favorite terms, are doing really well. But what we have to do is to find a way to evaluate corporations on more than just their short-term bottom line. They need to be evaluated on how they treat their workers. So, for instance, look at Costco, which is a classic example of a big box store which treats its workers well, and where a lot of people shop, including me. And then one of the reasons I shop there is for good prices and quality products, but another reason is because they treat their employees correctly. They treat their employees well. And the more of that we have, I hope the more people will shop. But it is a competitive world out there. And manufacturing, again, I started by saying this, Wisconsin was a strong manufacturing state. We built SUVs and Harleys and outboard motors and refrigerators and ice machines like nobody else.
Right.
Except that now other places can produce them cheaper than we can.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to be difficult. What is possible, high-level skill jobs and technology jobs and so forth, depend a lot on having more education and training. So yeah. We have to get people more prepared.
Thank you, Professor Smeeting. And then we have to say goodbye. This is a huge issue, and rest assured we will talk more about it in the days and months ahead. Professor Timothy Smeeting, Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Director of the Institute for Research on Poverty. Thanks to Judith Sears-Poisson for production. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for on-air production here in Milwaukee. And that's it for this hour. Please join us, hour number two. It should be a fascinating conversation. And tomorrow, a lot of people this week were asking what happened to global warming. We'll be talking about that with climate scientist Jennifer Francis of Rutgers University about the polar vortex tomorrow during this hour.